for West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, I speak with organizers from the Entrepreneurship Day event in downtown Kalamazoo for aspiring and current business owners. But first, I talk with Leisha Brooks, Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. She's the keynote speaker for this year's Kalamazoo Summit on Racism, scheduled for November 19th. Leisha Brooks says the center has seen a big spike in cases of bias and hate since last fall's presidential election. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Earlene.
Tell us a little bit about the Southern Poverty Law Center.
The Southern Poverty Law Center was founded in 1971 in Montgomery, Alabama. Our co-founders, Morris Dees and Joe Levin, both native Montgomeryans who experienced their own transformation during the Civil Rights Movement. You can imagine they grew up in a Montgomery that was indicative of the Jim Crow era, and they're both white men, but had a real kind of change watching the city of Montgomery change around them. So after the Civil Rights Movement ended in 68-70, they said they wanted to do something to really continue the work that had been done. So they founded SPLC as a small civil rights law firm. And our early cases were actually suing the state of Alabama to comply with, the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And sadly, that some of that same work continues to this day.
You now actually address lots of different issues besides just racial ones, including immigrant justice, LGBT rights, and things like that.
We're probably most well known for civil lawsuits against the Klan and groups like that.
I'd like to talk about that case. What was it, in 1988? There was a big judgment given at that time as it regards the Klan.
That was our first successful civil suit against a hate or extremist group. And it started in 1981 when a group of Klansmen that were affiliated with the United Klans of America abducted and murdered and lynched a young black man, Michael Donald, 19 years old. He was just on his way home from work, and they abducted him and then kind of murdered him, brought him back to a neighborhood in Mobile and lynched him from a tree very near the Klan leader's home so he could watch this drama play out. It was simply awful. This Klan organization, the United Klans of America, was responsible for the bombing at 16th Street Baptist Church that killed those four girls. And they also were responsible for attacking Freedom Riders when they came through Montgomery in the 60s as well. So they had done some really bad things, but to think that they were still kind of, committing these heinous murders in 81 was just awful. So Morris decided to, what can we do to kind of get rid of these organizations? And so he came up with the idea of suing the Klan in civil court, holding the leader responsible for the actions of its members. And it took a few years. In 1987, an all-white jury in Mobile returned a judgment in Michael Donald's mom's favor. Mrs. Beulah May Donald received a $7 million judgment. She didn't get $7 million, but she was quite satisfied with the fact that Klan group had been bankrupted. And we've probably had 14 or 15 such cases since the Donald case.
Now let's go to modern day. How has hate groups changed since the civil rights days to now?
The first thing that came to my mind when you said, how have they changed? And I flashed on, Charlottesville. And so let me just start there. That scene of racial intimidation was reminiscent of the Jim Crow era, kind of what launched the civil rights movement. We hadn't seen a protest or gathering like that since the 50s. So it has changed somewhat, yes, and then some things are certainly still the same. Probably the major change is that these group members are recruited or radicalized, as we say, online. So it's not necessary for them to join a group, join the Klan, or join a neo-Nazi group, but they can, as Dylan Roof, the murderer of those 9 African Americans in Charleston, proved that you can become radicalized online and commit these murders without ever attending a Klan meeting or any other meeting.
Are you feeling that some of these white supremacist groups are feeling a little more emboldened to be more public with their positions as opposed to being underground like the Klan used to be?
Sure. The Charlottesville group, right? I mean, they're not even covered. Their faces are shown. They're proudly, you know, shouting these blood and soil as to the camera, you know, so there's no shame at all. We have definitely noticed an emboldenment from people who have some affiliation or association with hate groups, and then those that just hold racist and bigoted thoughts. And this really began during the presidential election season, and then once Mr. Trump won, they just were kind of jubilant and felt like it was the end of what they call political correctness, and they could just, you know, vocalize whatever hateful thought that came to their mind. And this encroachment on in Charlottesville on the campus of UVA, we've seen it, you know, repeated in college campuses across the country. One of the things we're doing is monitoring the nonstop, what feels like nonstop flyering by white nationalist groups openly recruiting on college campuses.
There's been, what, 850 reports of bigoted harassment and intimidation immediately following the election?
That is correct. What we saw right after the election was this incredible uptick in the number of bias-related incidents that happened. We saw, you know, the swastika. We saw Trump campaign slogans being weaponized against folks. You know, hateful things like "Make America White Again." Kind of these people being kind of pushed off the sidewalk. Muslim women with a hijab having their hijabs torn up. Just all of this thing was going on. So we decided to put up a web portal that asked people to report, you know, bias-related incidents that either had happened to them or they had witnessed. And as you said, within 10 days, we had close to 1,000. We kept that up. It's still up, actually. But our last accounting runs November 9th through the end of March, and we have over 1,800 now.
And of those different instances of bigotry that you did document within the first 10 days after the election, there was a sizable number or a good group that took place at K-12 schools and some at universities. And these figures I'm looking at here was 183 at K-12 schools, another 140 at universities.
Yes. What we did, we looked at the data and tried to determine kind of what was the primary motivation behind this uptick in bias incidents, and really found that the number one thing was anti-immigrant sentiment, which, you know, kind of echoes or is a direct result of the rhetoric that went forth during the campaign. And then we also looked at kind of where these things happen, and as you said, K-12 schools came in number one. It's extremely disturbing. We have a project at the Southern Poverty Law Center called Teaching Tolerance that provides free anti-bias curriculum to educators across the country. We surveyed about 5,000 teachers, and they reported that things were pretty bad, that what was being spread during the campaign, this anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rhetoric, was showing up on K-12 campuses, and teachers really, you know, were at a loss as to kind of how to address it. For the first time, lots of teachers reported to us that they didn't want to teach anything about the election, and that's something typically that they look forward to, but they were running into issues with, you know, didn't want to speak out against parents who were Trump supporters, and just really kind of felt at a loss. So when Mr. Trump won and we saw this uptick, we decided to go back to our teachers and survey them. And this, right after the election, we surveyed 10,000 teachers, and they reported an increase in anxiety that now that Mr. Trump had won.
Increased anxiety among the students
teachers,
or among the teachers?
Okay. Amongst the teachers based on what they were observing.
So this bigotry was mostly among students?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Telling their classmates, oh, Trump won, you know, you're going to get kicked out of the country. Even pulling black kids into this. Oh, you're going back to Africa.
This is West Southwest on WMUK. We're talking to Leisha Brooks from the historic anti-hate group, the Southern Poverty Law Center. She headlines the November 19th Kalamazoo Summit on Racism. Her talk is titled Hate Groups in Michigan. We rejoin the conversation with Ms. Brooks answering the question, what should student protesters do when they encounter alt-right groups on their campus?
Well, the Southern Poverty Law Center recommends that students engage or host an alternate event, that they don't, you know, our first best strategy is that they don't attend the rally or the speaking engagement that's being hosted by white supremacists. The primary reason for this is that they depend on student protesters to bring media attention, to kind of create a spectacle, if you will, that allows them to present themselves as the aggrieved party, and that, you know, they're having their free speech rights infringed upon. What we do is tell students, hold another event, get everyone to come to your event, bring the media and the student body to your event, and strongly protest what it is they're doing.
I'd like to talk solutions. And one thing that I noticed, particularly after Charlottesville, Virginia, is this. There were these images, like you say, that were published of different white supremacists, you know, and people were outing them. And people were soliciting their names online, publicly trying to, I guess what amounts to shaming these individuals and identifying them for their beliefs. In some cases, people lost their jobs. What do you think of that as a response?
This is called doxing, and that is it's exactly as you describe it. It's kind of outing the people. Now, I can certainly understand why some people would want to do that. One, you want to kind of know who's in your community, right? But we stand against kind of sharing people's personal information. If you want to kind of identify the person and say, oh, that person was there, you know, Jim Jones or whoever was there, okay, fine. But you should not, we say you should not kind of give out people's personal information. It happened a lot with college students.
They were saying where they work, they were giving their address.
That's right. And that's a little over the line. And then, of course, there was the other thing about, which I thought was a pretty kind of amazing, when people were across social media identifying people at Charlottesville who were engaging in violence. And so in that way, they were helping law enforcement identify these folks, you know, so that is a good result.
Speaking of online, something else that I seem to be noticing, I don't know if you notice it, is kind of, I would say, it feels like an increase in allies for people of color, the LGBT community, allies for those groups whenever they feel that someone is engaging in some type of online bigotry, feeling very comfortable to just kind of stand up and speak out and say that's wrong. What do you think about the importance of doing that online, of people just saying, hey, that's not okay?
I think that's what people should be doing. I mean, if we don't, we run the risk of normalizing this type of behavior. We began to see this folks standing up for one another. I really have to credit the student movement vis-a-vis Black Lives Matters and standing up for racial justice organizations that began in the wake of the increase in police violence against unarmed African Americans. That kind of really began it, and I think we're continuing there from there.
Okay, when we talk solutions, let's say the issue is racism. Is it the role of white people to speak out? Is it more effective for white people to speak out on that? Should people of color speak out? I'm not talking about just activism. I'm talking about, let's say, online. You know, you'll see something. What is the more effective strategy? If someone in the group is doing something wrong, is it better that the checking, so to speak, occurs at the hand of the person within their group?
Well, I think both, right? And this really speaks to what I think this organizing effort by Standing Up for Racial Justice is doing. It's essentially a white group where they kind of talk amongst themselves about issues of systemic oppression and racism and what have you, so that they can educate themselves and become more effective, informed allies and work to dismantle the system independent of the targeted groups or people of color. But to your question, I think that both should happen, right? I as an African-American woman, I can and should say something. That doesn't mean that I have to go into a long kind of education explanation with the person who doesn't understand. That should happen from kind of an internal group thing. So what I'd like to see is, I'd like to see kind of, you know, white folks talk to white folks on a regular basis, just kind of even as this, as we're experiencing kind of heightened racial tensions in the country, then I think white folks should take advantage of this opportunity and begin to talk about race in different ways. Talk about it kind of, you know, amongst yourselves, with your family, with your friends, that kind of thing. The ways that kind of people of color have been doing forever. As we experience this kind of demographic shift in the United States and the rise of white nationalism, it's important that they do that. I mean, they cannot kind of stay out of this conversation or be race neutral or see things as, you know, be colorblind. That those kind of views of the world, you know, are not helpful.
I've seen you quoted talking about how that change in demographics is leading to some increased bigotry and had that environment ripe after Trump was elected. Those numbers that I saw that you've been quoted as is in the 1970s, when your organization was started, that whites were about 83% of the population, non-whites about 17%. Today, whites are about 66% and non-whites about 34%. And I see that your organization is projecting by the year 2050 that whites will be about 49% and non-whites 51%.
Well, we began to kind of see this early on, and you could probably bring it back to the election of Barack Obama in 2008, that this is probably when this thing that's now referred to as white racial anxiety kind of began to peak. Oh my gosh, you know, there's an African-American president, and what does this mean kind of, you know, for us, for white folks? The demographic shifts, it's not SPLC's prediction. This is, you know, these are demographers who've been saying this for years. In places across the country already have flipped into what they term, which I don't like the term, majority-minority states like California and some places along the border. And so now it's beginning to manifest itself in the Southeast and the Midwest, and people are beginning to pay attention. So it does create this feeling that, oh, we're being, you know, displaced, or this is what the white supremacists would have white folks believe.
We've been talking with Leisha Brooks, the outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. She's the keynote speaker for the Kalamazoo Summit on Racism being held on November 19th at the Lawrence Education Center at Borges Medical Center. The Summit on Racism is sponsored by the Society for History and Racial Equity, the Kalamazoo Community Foundation, Borges, along with about seven other partners. We have a link on our webpage for registration and other details. Visit WMUK.org.